listeners, and welcome to My Shit Therapist. In this episode, I'm talking with Emma, an author who writes under the name E.L. Norey. She was born in Cardiff, grew up in Care, went to boarding school in Devon, and eventually moved to London. Emma was diagnosed with bipolar disorder after a manic episode that started during a visit to New York's Ground Zero, the site of 9/11. Her illness manifested itself in visual and aural hallucinations and mania, which, when she arrived home, resulted in her being sectioned, first in an NHS ward and then in the Priory, a famous private rehab clinic in the UK. Emma's a brilliant storyteller. I think you're going to love this episode. Let's get into it.
Are we even in lockdown number what, three?
It doesn't feel like it, does it? Because I know this is probably a bit irresponsible, but I'm just like backing away from the news now. I just think if there's anything I need to know, it'll pop up and I'll find out somewhere. But I can't keep tuning in every day to find out what the death toll is.
Oh my God, I don't think that's irresponsible at all. I think that's exactly right, and what we should be encouraging everyone. Yeah, it's so weird, isn't it? And I'm sure people are having the same repetitive weird conversations, but yeah, I stopped.
It's the balance between being informed and making sure that you're informed and actually just wearing yourself out.
It's like that information thing about anything though, isn't it? We're so busy thinking we should. And it'll be of benefit to us to be informed, to know. I want to know stuff. I want to know. And then we can't do call. You know what I mean? We can't do anything. So that cycle of kind of feeling more helpless is just exacerbated. It's kind of, anything massive, you know, like dinosaurs wake up again or whatever.
Yeah.
Someone
will find a way of getting in touch with me and telling me. But I do worry, and I was talking to someone about this yesterday. I worry whether it's making us a bit more apathetic politically. I feel like a lot of us have been more politically active in the last couple of years than we have in our lifetimes. I mean, particularly if you look at, like, you know, the younglings, the kids, the Generation Z, but when it's just everything is just relentlessly awful all the time. If it's not, you know, more death, it's the riots that were in the US last week, or it's the fishing businesses, and if it's Brexit, and it's COVID, and it's this, and it's that, and it's just, there's no recovery time. There's no time to sort of recover from one thing and meet it and deal with it and absorb it and sort of get yourself back up to your full capacity before taking on the next thing.
Yeah. And there's no decompression either. Like,
no.
Where you could be with mates in a pub and then discuss the news together. I mean, it's, you know, if they're proper friends, then you're talking online. That's great. But that thing of sitting around with a group of friends and kind of, you know, discussing it and analysing it and all kind of chipping in together, having that discussion on Twitter or whatever doesn't feel the same, and it isn't the same, and you're still left with what you brought to that conversation. So yeah, it's just like, it's that whole thing of, you know, an animal chasing its own tail or whatever.
Yeah, and I do worry about what could happen to friendships and to relationships when we're just doing stuff online. I'm really lucky. I've got, like, every week I do a quiz with my mates, which is lovely, and we all just chat shit and it's great. And I talk to my family and my sister, and I'm very, very lucky that I've got a lot of people who check in with me because I live alone. But I do notice the impact of planning. Right, we're gonna talk between the hours of 9 o'clock and 11 o'clock at night, or we're gonna talk between 7 and 8 o'clock. So you don't have the time for the incidental stuff.
Yes.
Or talking to strangers. I really miss talking to strangers.
Yes.
What I wouldn't give to be in a girl's toilet in a pub.
Oh my God, those days for me are so long ago. But yeah, I would. Oh my God, yeah. But sometimes they were the best bit of the night.
They genuinely were.
Yeah. You'd go and you'd be like, you look all right. And it was all obviously helped with a bit of drink, but genuinely compliments flowing and that kind of openness and your new best mate.
Well, yeah, beautiful stuff.
How have you found it living alone? Is it terrible? Is it, you know, what, how?
I mean, I love living alone. I'm really lucky. A couple of years ago, I got a little, I was able to rent a tiny little studio in Bristol, like a kitchen with a bed in it, pretty much, and a cupboard.
Did it open straight onto the fridge?
Yeah, and a cupboard with a shower and a toilet in it. But right. It was mine and I could live there on my own because I just got to the point where I just can't live with other people. I just can't live with housemates anymore. And I honestly worry that so many people are in the situation, especially in cities, especially in, I mean, Bristol now as well, but in London in particular, if you're not in a position where you feel really mentally well and safe in your home space, if there's no respite from being around people who
you're not choosing to be with,
you're not choosing to be around. Yeah. If you don't have the option of surrounding yourself with the, you know, just being able to commandeer the kitchen for 3 hours to make soup is a lovely thing.
And being able to walk around naked and just listen to what you want to listen to.
Listen to what you want to listen to.
Take a poo with the door open and just stuff like, yeah.
Yeah.
And having, I am a bit too much information.
No, right. Go for it. Like the things that I got a cat foisted on me in February and the things she's seen. But honestly, having a little furry companion, it does make such a massive difference. I talk to her and it's just, it honestly breaks up the day. Like, especially in the first lockdown when it was just this limbo of what am I supposed to do with these big chunks of time? Feeding the cat, kind of picking up the cat's turds from next to the litter tray. All of that, all those little things, it sort of gave me a purpose.
But I think it totally does. Like we I live in a flat, first floor flat, and we don't have any pets. But at one point in my life, I was fostered in Suffolk, and the woman there bred cats. She bred Cornish Rexes, and we had like 15 in the house. And I've always loved cats. Yeah, and they're really weird looking as well. But that whole thing of that purpose thing, and just that thing of finding anything that takes you out of your own head.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So it's like, I have kids to feed.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So I can't be, like, I just can't be in at certain stages. And then if you've got a cat to feed and to clear up their shit, then you have to do it. And then it's that thing of, our brains are so, you know, are so mental, aren't they? But, you know, you take yourself out of your brain and your body is doing something and moving. You're opening a tin of cat food and you're mashing it up and you're putting it into a bowl. And then suddenly you're not thinking about, you know, whatever it is that may be making you sad or anxious or whatever. You're doing something else. And then hopefully just that tiny bit of doing something else for someone has meant that thought can just pop off for a bit.
Yeah, I think doing things for other people is something that I've really missed. At Christmas time, I loved I sent people cards, which I've never really bothered with before, because everyone I wanted to wish a Merry Christmas to, I could see them in the flesh and say Happy Christmas. But it was really nice to take some time to write these cards to, you know, the dozen or so of my favourite people and say I miss you and I wish you a Merry Christmas.
Thinking about it. Yeah, that's nice.
So you've got a hell of a story to tell me. I'm going to start with the first thing that was in your email. So how did you come to be diagnosed as bipolar? What was the relationship of that with 9/11?
Well, I'll just say the disclaimer. I'm a 45-year-old woman And I really do believe that any kind of sense of humour or ability to laugh at ourselves is essential to survival. So if I'm using the terms mental, crazy, mad, it's not meant in any disparaging way whatsoever. And that's just how I talk. And I really hope, you know, my wish is not to cause offence. We've all got how we tell our own story. And yeah, I'll, you know, I am trying to be aware of it, but I don't want to censor myself. I just want to have a natural chat with someone who's doing something very interesting and that's important. Yeah, so November 2001, yeah, so just after 9/11, I went to New York with with a good girlfriend at the time. So I was living in London, South London, and I was working. I was a kind of admin-y, executive-y type assistant, and I was 25, 26. So at the time, kind of prime of life, yeah, like just, you know, I had a boyfriend. We're quite serious. We'd moved in together. Anyway, I was going to New York. It was shopping trip. It'd been booked for ages, obviously, before all of 9/11. And we were just going to shop and club. And but I hate flying. I'm not a good flyer. And, oh, man. Yeah, so we got there. And I'm very high energy anyway. Yeah, I'm very... Well, lots of people think I'm an extrovert. I'm very talkative. I'm very open. I'm very nosy. Love meeting new people. Love just kind of like, you know, kind of always like that. And I wanted to go and see Ground Zero. And I wanted to go and see the site. But I was there and it was all cornered off. And I remember looking through, you know, like the... It was all boarded up and looking through gaps to see the holes in the ground and reading. The really moving thing was reading all the poems of all the people that had been missing and all that kind of shit. That was mad, mad. And I remember being there and kind of saying out loud, in my head, out loud, if you know what I mean, kind of saying, is there any kind of God, you know, how can this happen? And then clear as day, so fucking freaky, clear as day, a voice like a proper booming bell, I just heard, I'm not religious now, by the way, I just heard what I kind of then later put onto it was the voice of God, right? What I was experiencing was religious mania, and my mania took that flavor for quite a while. Anyway, so I asked that question out loud, and in my head, I heard a massive reply, very loud, and it just said, I gave you free will. I haven't done this. You've done this to yourselves. And then I kind of turned around. At this stage, all in hindsight, retrospect, diagnoses, all that business, I was at a stage which is called hypomania, which is the stage before mania, as people may or may not know, which is when usually, not this time, but usually it's all the good shit. You know, got loads of energy, feel really creative, not quite mad yet, not hearing voices, not seeing things, just kind of energized, feel really creative. And a lot of time when people don't want to take their meds. I turned around and there was this woman in a beautiful royal blue coat who kind of said, do you want to know Jesus? I've been sent here today from Philadelphia to, you know, bring Jesus to people. And already I was like, no, I'm all right, thanks. My mum's a born again Christian. I'm fine. I'll talk to her about it. And then, so that kind of started it all. And then everything just ramped way the fuck up. We were going shopping anyway. It was the whole Thanksgiving sales. Spent loads of money, all the classic signs that if you looked up bipolar, you know, overspending, flirting, all that stuff. Anyway, was pretty nuts on the plane home. From someone who'd been scared of flying, I was trying to walk up and down the aisles and being like, "Ask me a double vodka and whatever." Got home to the little flat, my little flat and my boyfriend, Ed. And no one kind of suspected a thing, really, because, you know, I'm very excitable. It wasn't full on then. Everyone hadn't seen me for a few days. So Ed was like, "God, you're quite excited. It's got to be jet lag." And I phoned my mum and I was like, "Oh, I'm kind of quite interested in Christianity now. You know, you've been talking about it for 10 years and I haven't been bothered, but maybe we could have a chat about it because maybe there's something to this God business." And she obviously, that was, you know, a dream for her, as an ex-heroin addict that we've been separated for years. She was like, whoa, she's coming over to my side. No one questioned anything. And then things kind of got worse, where the hypomania turned into full-blown mania over the course of... There's a lot of humour in being unwell, isn't there, though?
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, there really is, isn't there?
Because the brain is a fascinating organ of neurons and stuff that we can't begin to understand. And when they start making connections, it was all the classic signs. So I was sleeping less, didn't need to sleep. Who wants to sleep? What's sleep for? My God, you've got an extra like 12 hours to do stuff. Writing stuff. But the religion thing was a big thing. So thank God I wasn't, Twitter and Facebook and stuff weren't around. Because one of the things I did was get on the computer and type up 5,000 words of fucking garbage, which I still have somewhere. All, like, I was determined that if I had a printer, I was going to print it out and hand it round to the neighbourhood in North London that I was, because everyone should know, you know, what I knew. Anyway, lots and lots of little things where it all got progressively worse, to which point we called in the flat in London, Ed, my boyfriend at the time, called out the ambulance because I was a bit like, maybe I'm having a panic attack, or he thought that. Ambulance came and I had suddenly switched into being kind of perfectly normal, whereas before I had been completely ranting, talking about myself in the third person. I'd laid out a shrine of books on the sofa because all their titles meant something specific, and if Ed could just work out what the titles meant, then he'd know my state of mind. Yeah, I mean, crazy connections. Where I was working at the time, thank the Lord, had, I don't believe in God, but thank someone, had private healthcare. So at the full state where I was going really, we had this terrible night where we'd called the ambulance out and then they'd gone, we think you're having a panic attack, take some deep breaths, and they'd left again. And after they left, my behaviour didn't change. And Ed was like, let's just go to bed. You just need to sleep. This is about a week after I got back from New York. And things had just been building and building and building in all sorts of different ways. yeah, weird stuff. I thought it was acceptable to serve him Ryvita and watermelon because you could really taste the flavour of stuff for like dinner. I was like giving him food like that. Like, that's what dinner is. And yeah, so there was one night, Ed was just like, we need to go to bed. This is at the sort of very, very peak of it. So Ed sort of went, we need to go to bed, let's just have some sleep. I couldn't sleep, I wasn't sleeping. One point I sat bolt upright and said to Ed, what's your biggest fear? And I can't remember what he said. And I said, my biggest fear is going mad. And then I saw his ear morph into like a pointy ear. The religion thing was still pretty full on, like the shape of a devil's ear. And kept him up, just shook him and said, you have to stay awake with me, you have to stay awake with me. I don't know what time of the morning this was. He was beside himself. And the next day, and I don't even know why he did this, but he thought the best thing to do would be to get me on a train and take me down to Devon to my mother's. And I think, you know, you've got to remember the time it was. Do you know what I mean? 2001. I'm 26. I've got no kind of parental background, you know, no parents to kind of get hold of for advice. Me and my mum had a very, you know, odd relationship. Ed's parents are Irish, working class Londoners, a bit older. He's never going to say to them, Emma's talking. You know, there was no awareness like there is now. No kind of helplines and no internet in that way, social media. Yeah, so anyway, so he got me on the train to my mother's, which is where that, you know, so much hilarity comes in, because I remember reading the Bible out loud, like, and singing out loud, like, and I remember getting to the train station. This is Waterloo, right? Waterloo, you know that big clock in London?
Yeah.
oh my God, and being mad, full on mad, like the person that we all, you know, we may or may not have seen that when we don't know anything about mental illness may have been frightened of. I mean, there's no reason to be frightened of them. You know, it's all inside. You don't even see who's in front of you. But I was sort of trying to push people out of the way of the queue. And I was obviously quite a hypochondriac. My mum's quite a hypochondriac. I don't know what it is. But I was really like, my boyfriend, he's got meningitis. We need to get to the front of the queue. We need to get tickets now. And just all being very disordered. I think it's the only time in my life I've heard Ed shout. And we've been together like 24 years. And he grabbed me both by the shoulders and he just went, sit the fuck down. And he pushed me down. So I sat like by the ticket barrier and he just went, just stay there. Cause I was properly like uncontrollable. Somehow he bought tickets. We got on a train, and on the train, it was all, Ed said that there was lots of people complaining about me. I don't remember anything except I wouldn't let him sleep. The religion thing was really, really fierce in my head. And I kept seeing him as Jesus and he was just trying to sleep. I'd kept him up all night. And every time he went to sleep, I slapped him. Anyway, got me off the train, got to my mum's place. I mean, my mum weren't in regular contact, you know? So we got to my mum's, but from there, it was just, you know, mania at 10. And I mean, it's really interesting. Not me personally, just mania and what it can do to your brain.
Mm. So did your mum understand what was...
No.
What did your mum think?
Well, I don't know. So again, she shouted at me. So I think there was something in a good way. So I remember them all sitting on the sofa at one end of the room and they were eating or some takeaway or something. But everything was religious to me then. So in my brain, and I'm not religious now, in my brain, I just had this picture of like the Last Supper and I was some deity that could kind of dispense wise wisdom and whatever. But, you know, I talk fast, I move fast, I'm kind of, you know, and at 26, I was kind of even more energetic than I am now. And I followed my mum upstairs. So, and she just yelled, and she yelled my full name, and she went, Emma Louise Marks! And I had a fit. I collapsed and had a kind of, not epileptic fit, but a mini fit. I've got a scar on my eye where I cut my eye. Thank God that happened, because I don't know what anyone was fucking playing at when I was talking like a crazy person. My mum's a heroin addict. Yeah, she was. She must have just thought I'd been on some bad drugs or something. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
She didn't say any of that. So the only reason an ambulance was called in Torquay was because I'd had a fit. So I'd fallen down and was convulsing and my eye was bleeding. So they called an ambulance. And then from there, I was sectioned because I was off my head. And that was late November, early December 2001. And I was, you see, the thing that quite a lot of people don't talk about in mental health and anything like full on hospital or being sectioned, it's a real, oh God, you know, that's when you want money. Do you know what I mean? Like no one talks about, not even just the working class, just if you've got no money, what that system is like. And I've been on the end of both things. And some mental health institutions are just terrifying. So, fuck yeah. Like, I was so manic or resistant that they took me somewhere and they were trying to inject drugs into me to calm me down. And I punched a nurse. And I was physically restrained by about four guys. And the adrenaline in my body was so much so that I fought them off and they had to give me something stupid. I've got records of it. Something stupid, like four times the dose that they would normally give someone to crank them down.
Yeah.
And then there's loads of stuff within that, within what seclusion was like. And then about a month later being on a mixed ward, which was horrendously weird. But when I came out, which was on Christmas Eve, and was dosed up on very, very heavy drugs that they don't even give people anymore, haloperidol, procyclidine, so I was a shuffling, kind of twitching, drooling person. When I came back to London, the job I was working had private healthcare. So after, when I was kind of functional and kind of calm, I went to Harley Street. Almost a cliche, isn't it? I'd never heard of it before.
Did you get a nip and tuck while you were there?
Oh, I didn't need a nip and tuck then, babe. I was 26. It was all like right where it was supposed to be. But she was brilliant. She was brilliant. So this isn't like a therapist. This was a psychiatrist. So I booked to see this woman. And I went into the office, and as far as I can remember, it was just me that first time. And I started talking to her, and she was just great. And it's those things that, you know, those moments you always remember. And she just looked at me and she kind of laughed, and she just went, "Oh, this is the easiest diagnosis ever, because you're still hypomanic."
Mm-hmm.
She said, and then she just said, "So three things will happen." And it was so great just to get clear, you know, information. She went, "Three things will happen." She went, "You'll go up, you'll go down, or you'll even out." I don't know whether she then said bipolar, but she said you're hypomanic, and it's really clear by what you're describing. The really kind of the classic symptoms: religious ideation, overspending, oversexuality, can't talk. You know, everything's got its own flavor, but it can have visual hallucinations or auditory with it. That is very, very peak if left untreated. And I was put on loads of meds, I think like an antipsychotic for a while. Left her office and was okay for a couple of days, and then went down like I've never had since. And anxiety like I've never had since, which is, I think anxiety is possibly the worst out of everything, out of mania, out of depression. I mean, anxiety is a beast to be feared. I'm just in awe of it. I mean, I just used to sit there chain smoking in my little flat, same thoughts, just going round and round. Went back to see her. I mean, saw her colleague and got some Valium, which didn't do anything. You know, tiny, tiny respite for a bit. And he wasn't as good. I don't know, I'd connected with her. I really liked what she had to say. But then through work, through private healthcare at work, got admitted to the Priory in Roehampton for about 6.5-7 weeks, which was... And, you know, an interesting and another experience entirely.
I asked Emma, how did it feel when you were diagnosed as bipolar?
I think I remember going, "Oh, thank God it's not schizophrenia," which age 26 was what my brain had told me was, you know, the worst possible thing ever.
Yeah, the worst possible thing. And that's more, I think it's something like anxiety and depression, and even bipolar to an extent. It's kind of an extension of something that's already familiar. So it's an extension of sadness. And, you know, we all know what anxiety before an exam feels like. So it's not that big a kind of imaginary leap. So it's easier to accept. Whereas if it's something like schizophrenia or psychosis or something where the symptoms aren't familiar, aren't as easy to empathize with from other people, that's much more frightening, I think.
Oh, absolutely. And that's what we need to educate about, because that's where the
absolutely
fear comes in.
Yeah,
and the demonization. It's like, so I had elements of psychosis hugely. And they're fascinating that the mind can do that. It's just, you know, there kind of are no limits to what the brain can do.
Yeah,
it would be nice to be able to be safe and to have some element of, you know, control and moderation, understanding and explanation of those things. But yeah, and I remember laughing and saying to her, "Thank God it's not schizophrenia." Like, as if at 26 I knew, you know, what that would be like. Or so she was great. This, you know, the first person I was very lucky enough to see. I mean, you know, I don't come from money, I come from living in care, but it was through work, through my job, had private healthcare. And then they took, you know, in the Priory, you know, I kind of had my lowest point, absolute catatonic depression, where I didn't move, I think, for like 4 days or something, and anxiety. And they just sort of tinkered with medication. Tinkered with medication to find the right doses, little bits of therapy, little bits of really useless therapy, hilarious therapy, meeting other people that, you know, a lot of I didn't necessarily meet anyone from my background, so a lot of people there did have money.
That's interesting.
That was great. I mean, but great as in...
It's the Priory, though.
Yeah, met some friends and had this wild kind of odd friendship with this woman who was much older than me, like twice my age, who had a sex addiction, which she was She was fun. She was loads of fun. And I had quite a kind of, yeah, just had quite a silly, in, you know, amongst the 6 weeks, lots was terrible. Lots was very, very funny. We all snuck out once to the cinema and went to see A Beautiful Mind, as if that's an appropriate thing to do. I don't think I'll ever be able to watch that film again, though, because we were all a bit like, a bit familiar.
I love that. Of all the films.
Yeah. Over that time there, I kind of let go or really managed to see my whole religious thing for what it was. I was very, very fortunate that I got to go to a place like that. I mean, it was just kind of a nice environment, but I had experienced when I had been iller, I had experienced other mental health services that were so far from ideal.
And is that when you were in Torquay?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's where you said you were in seclusion. So were you isolated? Yeah. And then you were in a mixed ward. Is that men and women?
Yeah. But I was 26. How inappropriate was that? Like, I was really, really unwell then. So the seclusion was terrifying, because I think anything to do with our brain, anything that we're going through, is going to be individualized, isn't it? You know, I'm no expert, but it's going to latch onto and associate with our own history or trauma, if people want to use that word, but it's going to connect with those things. So when I was secluded,
sounds like you're in solitary confinement. Is that right?
Yeah, it was. Well, I had I had this whole section to myself that was, I wasn't allowed. Ed and my mum, I was so disordered that Ed and my mum weren't allowed to see me, and they had to watch me on CCTV monitors in a proper cell, like tiny room, mattress with a plastic sheet on it in case obviously you weed or pooed yourself. It was an empty room, nothing in there that you could harm yourself with or anything, locked, tiny fucking prison cell, like a tiny thing like that. And even worse, I don't know my dad. So I've never known my dad, and I obviously had some issues to work through at that age. So I was a bit like, I don't know, I kind of thought someone was coming to rescue me, or I was kind of really distressed. When I was let out of there after however many hours, or, you know, more people would come in and dose me up, when I was drugged up enough to be let out, there was a bathroom that when I used to use, I used to think I was communicating to people on the outside. So I had, you know, SOS, certain amount of times I did the light switch and all that kind of stuff. But what was kind of most interesting to me about that time was how all words failed me. So I created my own sign language that no one could understand, but I stopped speaking because there was kind of no point. And I just would kind of move my hands around the only place I would sleep was, they had this colourful beanbag, and I used to try and snatch kind of little pieces of time there, whilst, you know, having the old check up every 5 minutes, or someone shining a torch in your face or whatever. But those kind of two rooms, or the seclusion room, the bathroom and the beanbag, were sort of behind another whole area. I don't think I was there for very long. I think it was about a week or something before being released into the kind of wild bit area, which it was only just like a slightly more modern version of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, really.
How was that different from, so in the Priory you would have been in a mixed ward?
Yeah, but it wasn't a ward. The Priory is like a hotel, darling. I had a beautiful room with an ensuite, and you know, it was a beautiful room, and there were meal times and a dining hall and a smoking room that all the walls were yellow. But I guess that's the same anywhere. It was lovely environment, but obviously, as I'm sure many people have said, you know, it doesn't matter where you are, you know, the demons are in your own head. So obviously it was much nicer to have my own room and not think, oh, some 70-year-old's going to show me his penis accidentally just by letting his robe fall open. Or, you know, I can sit in these ratty old chairs that are manky as heck and stare at a TV and some absolute 6-foot guy who's properly still psychotic has got the remote and I won't dare say anything. You just used to hover near the nurse's station in case you would be. But that's, you know, that's my own mental illness dealing with my own prejudices at that time. So I felt quite fearful as a young girl. But looking at it now and knowing what I know, I doubt any of those people would have harmed me. They wouldn't have run the ward, as it were, in that way if there were people, you know, abusing or hitting other people. But the point is that the nature of how ill I was at the time, it, you know, it's not appropriate. But, you know, the NHS is strapped and all that. And also, I used to do this stupid thing where I would not take my meds, like as if I was in the film of my own, you know, or I stuck it under my tongue. And I don't know how long I did that for, but that's not very helpful, is it?
Did you know that you were ill?
The insight thing is really strange. So you know something's not right. So before it's full on, there's a moment before it turns, yeah? It's like a relationship. I don't know. The excitement and stuff is all a bit, there's lots of good stuff to be got from that. You do feel like you're having access to a privilege, like a special world. Like, it's so hard to explain without sounding bonkers. So for me, there was this connection with words and language and sensing people's, I don't know, like my ability to kind of read people was like off the chart correct, or I thought it was correct. In Torquay in the ward, there was this thing where everyone I saw or everyone I interacted with was a version of my mother. And I didn't, you know, and I didn't grow up with my mum. So there was a nurse and I was like, that's how my mum would be if my mum was 22, and she wasn't. So I'd mapped everyone. They're pawns in your own game, in your own mental game, if you know what I mean. So I don't think then I was like, oh, I know I'm unwell. You're just taken out of your life for a bit, you know. Someone's just gone, here you go. And I was in, you know, mad land for however many months, which is nothing you can do about it. You don't know about it. When you're lying in bed in the Priory, you know, and you open your eyes and just for one, there's like 2 seconds where you think, maybe it's gone. Or you don't even think that. You just open your eyes and then... and then the anxiety crashes in your life, for fuck's sake. Then it's gutting knowing you're not well or knowing things aren't right or that you're limited or you won't be able to do what you want to do. And as someone who had never before suffered from that crushing depression, I mean, that's just, yeah.
Like, that's devastating, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I was 27 when I had a major depressive episode, which is I just had a breakdown and I just had to go to bed and cry for 2 weeks. And the thought that I kept coming back to was like, I'm a mad person now, and I'm never going to be right again. I'm never going to be the capable, creative, go-getty person that I was before. I'm broken in a way now, that and I'll never be fixed. And that's devastating, especially when
God, yeah, you're that young.
Looking back, I can see things that happened, you know, when I was a teenager in my early 20s and go, oh, that was depression or that was anxiety. But there wasn't a precedent for that kind of absolute devastation.
Did something kick that off, do you think, in the weeks or months leading up to that big episode?
Yeah.
What had been going on for you?
So there were loads of little, well, I say little, there was loads of life, big life things that happened one after the other. So yeah. Over about 6 months. So first of all, my dad had a stroke. Like, he was fine. It was a minor thing and he's never had one since, such wood, but like, my dad's never ill. He's like this stoic Welshman. So that was really devastating. And I got a new job at a comedy agency. So similar to the one that you were in the entertainment industry, where it was just working mad hours all the time. Yeah. I worked at the Edinburgh Fringe, which was kind of mad 14, 18 hour days, which was brilliant, but huge. And then I moved house. I moved in with my partner for the first time ever.
Yeah.
So it was all this big life stuff that happened one thing after another. And it was like we were talking about earlier, there was no decompression in between. There was no time to recover. So it was just this constant stress. And for about 2 months, I was just weepy all the time at work and just exhausted. And I just kept thinking, I'm just tired. I'm fine. I just need the weekend, or I just need the holiday. And then Christmas happened and I had 2 weeks off and I was like, right, that's it. That's all I need. I had a breakdown and didn't go back and had to quit.
Yeah. We need so much to do in the world of fucking work and just, you know, life generally, because it's that thing. And I think it's quite a key age sometimes, that sort of mid early 20s.
Yeah.
One of the most useful things a therapist ever said to me was, first of all, my thought as I was clinically depressed, catatonic, which I've never been before or since, but lying there unable to move, the whole thing on a loop was, that's it now. I'm going to be like this forever. I'm going to be like this forever. I'm fucked, you know, and I will be that bag lady on the street talking to herself with a big shopping bag, proper mental, you know.
Yeah,
that was my fear, and that everything's ruined kind of thing. Which obviously doesn't help us. And we know that we don't, you know, we're so keen to put things, labels on things and fit things in boxes, that I don't think yet we've fully embraced that whole fluidity of the different levels of mentality. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Like, it's binary, isn't it? You're either chronically depressed or you're cured.
Yeah.
Like, you're either suicidal or you're running ultra marathons, and there's no in between, which is where most of us live most of the time.
Absolutely.
That's where you have to manage your illness, isn't it?
Yeah. And that whole thing of, you know, when there's loads going on. So, you know, I remember someone saying to me once, oh, well, and they didn't mean it. It's fine. I don't take offense. But that whole thing of, well, maybe this is always going to happen, as in, you know, the background you've had, you know, that whole kind of patronizing, you know, well, with a junkie addict mother and not knowing your dad. And
God,
lots of people feel and think that. And so that thing of, I don't need to listen, or I don't need to be empathetic, because it's not going to happen to me. So that thing about, it's really important that it can happen to anyone. And it might, and loads of stuff going on can be good stuff. You know, loads of stuff for me was good stuff. People are all like, oh, someone's lost a job or whatever. So your stuff was probably so many culminations of dreams coming true, not your dad, but
most of it was good stuff, but it was big life stuff.
Yeah, same. I put myself through university, no parental support. Luckily, education-wise, I was the last, you know, whatever, to get a grant. But I worked all through uni, so I wasn't in touch with my mum. Everyone used to go back to their lovely families, or not lovely families, but everyone had somewhere to go except me. I worked all the way through uni, and I finished uni and moved to London, and then got my dream job in publishing through an agency for like a year, and then that all fell apart because the company bought another company. And that was all I wanted to do. And then I kind of got into a sidestep wrong job, but I had no parental guidance. I had no one from the ages of, you know, zero, no one to guide me or say what to do. And I'd been so sort of self-starting, and met a boy and it was going all right, and moved in with him. And then this therapist was just great. And she just said to me, your brain just went, ah, everything's all right. Now I can fall apart. Sometimes it's when things are all right, if you've been keeping it together, even for like years, months, whatever, when you're at your most sort of secure and all right, is when your brain can go, now it's safe for you to fucking fall apart. And then you, what you do with it after that. And it was so interesting to me. And I'd never thought of it like that or seen it like that. I got my record. Well, there were two really good things that sort of helped me. So one thing that really helped me, very lucky indeed, is I had got a childhood friend that I went to boarding school with. So I was born in Cardiff, lived there till I was 10, in children's homes, and then got fostered out sort of 11, 12 to a terrible, terrible placement, terrible. And then because it was all so terrible, from there, they sent me to boarding school. Cardiff Social Services had to pay because I was under their jurisdiction. And there I met a friend who we're really close still today, very opposite lifestyles. But she ended up being a psychiatric nurse. And now she's quite kind of high up in what she does. And in those early days, after leaving the Priory and having no one to talk to and no access to anything, you know, no money for any kind of therapy or anything like that, apart from NHS type stuff, which is all dreadful. Sorry, it was back in the day. Oh, so dreadful. But it was great because I would have her. So she was then fully trained and I could say to her, oh, I'm feeling XYZ. And she would be like, you know, what kind of level of XYZ? And are you writing poetry at 4 in the morning? And have you decided that you don't need food because you can exist on whatever? And she would maybe gently suggest going to, you know, doctors or just cutting back on the social calendar. For me, I've always wanted to know about stuff. So the same friend is someone that when they're in debt, they didn't actually like to look at their bills or open their, you know what I mean? Mm. Open their post. And I've always been someone that if you just to know about stuff, curious about stuff, and, you know, then if you know something, you can do something about it. So when I was kind of, you know, wheeled out with a, this is called bipolar and this is what you can expect, and we can't give you antidepressants because they can send you high, but, you know, you could, this is what you can do and you need to learn your triggers and all that sort of stuff. I just went and bought loads of books about it, about bipolar, but wanted people's lived experience. There's a woman called Kay Jameson, An Unquiet Mind. And just kind of tried to, very slowly and over lots and lots of years, do you know what I mean? Just tried to work out what that meant for me, what that label meant for me, how useful it was or not, if that could explain other instances in my, you know, life, teens. And was it helpful? It's like, you know, if a label is helpful to you. And over the years, it has been and it hasn't been, you know. So over the years, for a while, I was kind of desperate to be one, to belong, I guess, to the bipolar club. Yeah. So I joined organizations and the MDF, the Manic Depression Fellowship, and went to meetings and did programs and all that sort of stuff. So this is, you know, late 20s still. And having a sense of community is really important. And I would love bipolar people to reach out and, you know, get in touch and whatever. I'm happy to talk about it. But also sometimes that isn't useful, you know, that really isn't. And I went to some NHS run course and there are so many different things that make up who we are. And I think medication can be really important. Antipsychotic medication saved my life. But medication can be really important and it can get you through. And one thing doesn't have to be all things, you know, it doesn't have to be, if you take meds now, you're on meds the rest of your life. It doesn't have to be, they're going to stop me being creative. No, they just might help you get 8 hours of sleep, you know. It doesn't have to stop you doing anything. That probably sounds a bit naff. I'm sure the world's moved on now. But so many people that I met in the early days, in my late 20s, early 30s, so, you know, still 15 years ago, but people were saying things like, I can't work, you know, or
I don't want it to turn me into a zombie.
Yeah, yeah. And, or just sort of taking that label and just letting it do the work for them. So that's it. I can't do anything now. You know, I can't, I'm bipolar. You know, I'm anxious, so I can't do a podcast because I'll get anxious about it. Do you know what I mean? And sometimes it's obviously different for everyone, but I do think it helps when people are doing stuff, anything, and talking about how that may or may not impact on their mood and their mental health and what has worked for them, which is what, you know, which is what your podcast is doing, which is fab. Because there is still a lot of, I'm old, aren't I? There is still a lot of misunderstanding and prejudice about it. You know.
Okay, so you've told me what the best thing a therapist ever said to you was that, you know, this is the time that your brain has chosen because you feel safe. What's the worst thing a mental health professional
There's so many, isn't there? So two that stand out. One thing is never, ever interview someone when they're manic. Like, interview them and make it a record, because you talk shit when you're manic. And I've got it on paper, all the things I said, and some of it, most of it was just lies. So especially about things like, they ask, you know, have you ever taken drugs or whatever? And I just told some lies, like just made up some shit. Like, instead of saying, oh yeah, I smoked a bit of pot when I was 17, you know, whatever. And I just told some lies. And then for that to be in a public record that follows you round in the system. So yeah, it was terrible. And I requested my records in 2014, and oh boy, they make some amazing reading. But yeah, so that's one thing, but that's not advice per se. But yeah, just don't take people when they're at their really, really ill. Write the stuff as if they know what they're talking about. And the other one, oh man. So after being pregnant, fine, had the baby, was a bit worried, like, oh, I'm prime candidate for postpartum, you know, psychosis and the depression after the baby and all of that kind of stuff, and wanted to sort of preempt all that. So I went to see someone. First of all, he kind of said, you're really attractive, you're well dressed, well presented, there can't be anything that much wrong with you, idiot. And then he then went on to prescribe the wrong medication, which was quite terrifying for a couple of months. So the way any kind of illness manifests itself for me is that if I feel anything like lack of sleep or overexcitement, I can kind of go up a bit. And it doesn't happen very often. And it didn't even happen like when my book came out last. I'm kind of over that a bit. But there were instances in the past when big things would happen, like a move or a job or whatever, and I could feel myself. And I'd normally go to the doctor, get olanzapine, cancel my calendar, sleep, eat, you know, and I'd be all right. I'd regulate. But this time he sort of said, I actually think you're not bipolar, and what you have known of yourself and managed your illness for the past 10 years is all rubbish. And I think you're cyclothemic, whatever that is.
Yeah.
And so we'll try on this medication. So he gave me this medication. Fuck. Oh, Michelle, it was so terrifying. And we trust these people. And so he basically was a guy saying, A, you're pretty and young, there's nothing wrong with you. And B, I know better than how you've managed to negotiate your whole life so far. So take this drug, even though I'm only seeing you for like 40 minutes once, right? But they're doctors and they're the people that are, you know. So I took this medication for a condition that I don't think I have. And it was terrifying. It was terrifying. So I had a proper horrible dream that I don't even think I can go into because it's too distressing. And then for about 2 weeks, my moods were just like nothing has ever happened before. So I went into a phone box and I phoned Ammo, my handy psychiatric nurse, to hand, and just explained what I was kind of thinking or feeling. And she said, the medication, I think, is causing you to have a mixed state. So you're, you know, kind of manic, like literally 1 hour, then you're manically depressed the next hour, then you're angry, like rage you've never known, like a few minutes later. So she just said, you've already been off all medication, Em. You just need to go back and get some olanzapine and get some sleep. And I suggest you come off this medication, you know, with the help of, you know, all the professionals. I wouldn't say get off them, but I sort of knew it was wrong in my body, but didn't trust my brain enough to. So, and that was really, really horrid. But that whole thing of women not being taken seriously, hysterical, is it your period? Is it an early menopause? And you look all right on the outside, so there can't be anything wrong with you.
So you must be fine.
Yeah. In a sort of dismissive, almost like you're wasting my time kind of attitude.
Yeah. Which is the last thing you need.
Absolutely. And normally it can take a lot to even get to that stage of going to your GP and,
yeah,
you know, or having to be off work, or it takes, sometimes it can take a while for you to realize that you're not coping or you might need some help. So you do wonder why some people are in that
kind, yeah, of why job. Why are you why did you choose to do this job?
Yeah. I'm really lucky. I have a really great husband.
And I have, Ed?
Yeah.
Still Ed?
Yeah, Ed. Yeah. He proposed. The proposal was so funny, right? We went to Brighton for the weekend and I was dosed up on, I mean, this is why it's hilarious. I was dosed up on Valium, like, and we went to the beach and it's a shingle beach, isn't it, Brighton? And I remember like saying to Ed, who's going to want me now? I'm mad. You know, I'm mad. Like, who wants a mad? And he was so gorgeous and he just got down on his knee and he went, oh, I was known you're a bit mad, and just proposed. I was like, and he was like, I was going to do it the night before, but you fell asleep in the curry. Like,
you fell asleep in the curry.
Yeah, just, well, I had to, well, not totally asleep, but the Friday night we'd gone for an Indian or whatever. And he was going to propose then, but I was like, you know, back in the day, Valium used to be powerful stuff.
You can follow Emma on Twitter at @elnori_writer. Thank you so much for listening. And if you have a story to share on the podcast, you can email myshittherapist@gmail.com or follow me on Twitter @myshittherapist. In the meantime, take care and take your meds. Bye.